Jana Ballaba Giri Badakari Yasodhanandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yasodhanandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tida Banachari Yamuna Tida Banachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari
Padavadikacharya Sotha, this is the Shri Srimad, Divine Grace, Sesi Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada Kijaya, ISKCON BBD founder of Charya, Srila Prabhupada Kijaya, Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Kijaya, Go Premanandi Hari Hari Bo, all glorious to the assembled devotees, all glorious to the assembled devotees, all glorious to the assembled devotees, Jai, glorious to Shri Shri Guru. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya So a reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd canto, 12th chapter, text 15. It doesn't have a purport. I'll chant that by myself, but we'll chant number 16 together. Okay? Iti adishta swaguruna bhagavan yalalohitaha satvakriti swabhavena sasarjatma sama prajaha. And the translation for that is, the most powerful Rudra, whose bodily color was blue mixed with red, created many offspring exactly resembling him in feature, strength, and furious nature. Text 16. Rudranam Rudra Shrishtanam. Rudranam Rudra Shrishtanam. Samantad Grasatam Jagat. Samantad Grasatam Jagat. Isamya Sankhya Soya Yutan. Isamya Sankhya Soya Yutan. Prajapatir Asankata. Prajapatir Asankata. Rudranam Rudra Shrishtanam. Samantan Grasatam Jagat. Nisamya Sankhya Soyutan Prajapatir Asankata Rudranam Rudra Shrishtanam Rudranam
Vishishtanam. Vaishnavis. Rudranam, of the sons of Rudra, Rudra Shrishtanam, who were generated by Rudra, Samantat, being assembled together, Grasatam, while devouring, Jagat, the universe, Nisamya, by observing their activities, Asankhyasaha, unlimited, Yutan, assembly, Prajapati, the father of the living entities, Asankata, became afraid of. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The sons and grandsons generated by Rudra were unlimited in number, and when they assembled together, they attempted to devour the entire universe. When Brahma, the father of the living entities, saw this, he became afraid of the situation. Report. The generations of Rudra, the incarnation of anger, were so dangerous to the maintenance of universal affairs that even Lord Brahma, the father of the living entities, became afraid of them. The so-called devotees or followers of Rudra are also a menace. They are sometimes dangerous even to Rudra himself. Descendants of Rudra sometimes make plans to kill Rudra by the grace of Rudra. That is the nature of his devotees. Om Agina Timirandasya Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshuda Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupakaramayam Didati Swapadantikam. Okay, so we have Maitreya Muni is speaking to Vidura here. That's the background situation. And he's telling him about a conversation now. It's relating to him a conversation that took place between Lord Brahma and now, in this particular section, Rudra. Okay? So that's what's going on here. And we've just got finished hearing about how the four Kumaras, they refused. Lord Brahma's trying to populate the universe. And he requested, his, I guess, eldest sons, the four Kumaras, to help in that regard, and they refused. They didn't want to take part in that, and Lord Brahma was not so happy about that, but it's mentioned in different ways that it was okay. That was a good decision on their part. They, you know, even though they disobeyed their father, it was justifiable because they had a higher, there's a higher principle involved, which was that they were seriously pursuing spiritual elevation. So, you know, for that consideration, it's acceptable to, you know, refuse the order of the father to get married and enter into household life. So they were okay. So now Lord Brahma is going to Rudra. He wants to see if he could help out. And Rudra is very willing to help out. And so Lord Brahma goes, okay, good. And he gives him his, you know, he gives him his names, his places designated for his residence, wives. He supplies him wives. And he says, now you are one of the masters of the living entities, and you may increase the population on a large scale. So he delegates that responsibility to Rudra. And Rudra is, Lord Shiva is very obedient, and he gets to work. And he actually generates a lot of population here, because it says here in the in today's purport, it said that the, what did it say, in the translation, actually, it says that they were unlimited. Where is that? Oh, here it is, yeah. The sons and grandsons generated by Rudra were unlimited in number. So he took Lord Brahma's instruction or request seriously, and he did it. Now, the problem is that, as mentioned in the translation that didn't have a purport, that these offspring of Rudra were exactly like him. They resembled him in features of strength and furious nature. Okay? And so they became, as mentioned in the purport, a menace. A menace, this dictionary definition of the word menace, is a person or a thing that is likely to cause harm. Okay? So they had... It's interesting because they had his they resembled him exactly in strength and furious nature. It's not stated one way or the other if they resembled him exactly in intelligence, because although Lord Shiva is very powerful, he's also very intelligent, and you know he knows how to control himself. I mean, it says here he's the incarnation of anger, but unlike his offspring, he doesn't just go destroying the universe willy nilly at any time. He waits for the appropriate time. And then he swings into action and he does his thing, right? But unfortunately, his offspring are not following in his footsteps. They're kind of, they lost it, you know, and they're creating havoc. So much so that not only is Lord Brahma afraid of that they're destroying the creation, Lord Brahma is actually afraid that they're going to destroy him. Actually, I think he just mentions in this thing that Brahma, the father of the living entities, became afraid of them. Because, and it says in the next translation that they have begun to devastate everything on all sides with the fiery flames from their eyes, and they have even attacked me. So what to speak of destroying the whole creation, which they were doing, they were even threatening Lord Brahma. You know, they were a menace to Lord Brahma, too. So that's what was going on. And so we're going to hear about how Lord Brahma, in light of this, in lieu of this, he's going to ask Lord Shiva or Lord Rudra to cease and desist. In other words, thank you very much. I'm very pleased that you're such an obedient son and you did exactly what I said. You generated lots of offspring. I think it mentions sons and grandsons. The sons, someplace. Yeah, it's the sons and grandsons generated by Rudra were unlimited in number. And very good, but it's not. You judge a process by the result. It's not working out, you know. Now you might think when you hear about sons and grandsons, immediately comes to my mind. Well, wait a second. Why did Lord Brahma leave this so long? Well, he delegated that responsibility to Rudra. Lord Brahma is not micromanaging the entire universe. That's what I get from that. Every word of the Bhagavatam has some meaning. You know, it gives you some insight into something, what's going on. So. If it was just sons, you could say, well, you know, before they can he could even work out what was going on. The sons started doing that. But his sons and grandsons, it was going on for a while, apparently, and then Lord Brahma kind of figured out, wait, this isn't working out. So that's, he approaches Rudra and tells him, hey, better chill out here. And Lord Rudra, what's his response to Lord Brahma? Well, he didn't say, like some these days somebody might say, hey, Dad, boys will be boys, you know, what can I do? And it is what it is. Now, that's not what Lord Rudra said, you know. He did a very exemplary response to Lord Brahma's request for him to cease and desist and, you know, perform severe penances and austerities. His response was, Rudra's response to Lord Brahma's order or instruction was that he addressed him with words of assent, and he entered, after circumambulating his father, he addressed him with words of assent, and he entered the forest to perform severe penances. So he was submissive. You know, he was humble and submissive. As powerful as he was, he was even that much more intelligent, and he complied with Lord Brahma's request, and he circumambulated him and with words of assent, and then he followed his instruction. So that's very good. Now, in the second part of the purport, Prabhupada, and this seems to be what Prabhupada's more concerned about, he makes an analogy. He uses this situation to make an analogy, and that is that the so-called devotees or followers of Rudra are also a menace. This is the real kind of the point of today's purport, that Prabhupada's pointing out that these, and he refers to them as so-called devotees. Why? Why are they so-called devotees? Well, because they're very motivated. You know, they're very much have ulterior motives. You know, and they're worshiping Rudra or Lord Shiva just to get some benediction. And when they get that benediction, they couldn't care less about Lord Shiva. And, you know, it's not like they're his disciples. They're following his instructions. No. They're just doing what they know. Lord Shiva is famous as Asutosha, which means he's pleased very quickly. You see? And it describes in the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam here that Lord Shiva can be pleased simply by somebody offering obeisances and the leaves of the bale tree. Not very difficult. You know, you pay obeisances and you offer the leaves of a bale tree, and maybe on top of that, you perform some austerity, and Lord Shiva is pleased and he'll give a benediction. And so therefore, he can be pacified by the lowest class of men. This is right out of the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam, chapter 4, text 24, chanting the prayer by Lord Shiva. So that's what they do, you see. The so-called devotees of followers of Rudra, they're also a menace. And there's the famous menaces, you know, so-called devotees or followers of Rudra are, well, who can give me a couple? Who are the most famous menace so-called devotees or followers of Lord Shiva? Ravana. Who else? We're going to get to him. Yeah, we're going to get him. Okay, I'm not familiar with him, but Ravana. Huh? Vanasura, yeah. Actually, Durvasa Muni, I don't know if it's... He was kind of like a menace. You know, people were pretty afraid of him because wherever, if you just, you know, just slightly do the wrong... say the wrong thing or do the right thing around Durvasa Muni, boy, you're going to get cursed. So he's kind of... could almost be in that category. Jarasandha was also a devotee or so-called devotee of Lord Shiva. He was going to offer he conquered those 20,000 kings or something like that, and he was going to sacrifice them to Kaila Bhairava, cutting off their head and sacrificing them. So, you know, also a menacing so-called devotee of Lord Shiva. So there's a list of them. And the thing is this, that these so-called followers, they're menaces to... Lord Shiva, I mean, the menaces, but Lord Shiva likes them, right? Because, you know, he's pleased with them, because after all, they're, you know, they're becoming, humbling themselves to him and asking for. He really likes them, right? No. No, Lord Shiva is not fond of those personalities. His position is like this. This is an analogy. So here in the United States, you have the tax system, okay? And people have to, if they earn money, they're supposed to make a tax return, you know, make a tax report and pay some taxes. And then if people do it smart, they can get a refund, you know, from the government, or they can pay less taxes. It's a system, you see? And there's people who are in charge of administrating that system, see? So it's not like, you know, if they give you a tax return, it's not because they like you. And if they don't give me a tax return, it's not because they don't like me. It's just how you interacted with the system, you see? So demigod worship is something like that. You're interacting with a system. And Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma is another example of that. You know, these personalities, they interact with the system, and if they interact in the correct way, then they feel obliged. You know, this is how it works. Okay, you did what you were supposed to do, so here's your benediction, like that. It's like, here's a better example, okay? Somebody's the warden of a high-security prison, let's say, and there's some guys in there that are, they're doing all the right things to get probation, you see? So the warden, he has to look at the records. Well, this guy, he's done all the right things. You know, he showed up every day at the roll call. He's done all his service duties, you know. He hasn't gotten any fights. He hasn't, you know, beat up any prisoners, you know. Okay, so I guess he's eligible for, probation. But at the same time, he's thinking, okay, I got to give him probation because he's fulfilled all the requirements. But I don't know, only God knows what this guy's going to do when he gets out there. I mean, he's a hardened criminal at heart, you see. So it's something like that. You know, he's kind of obligated to, because the person's fulfilling the requirements. But at the same time, it's not like he's, you know, really happy about those people. So Lord Shiva's like that. He's, you know, it's his service, it's part of his service. So, there are a couple exceptions to that. I mean, Banasura, somebody mentioned Banasura. Apparently, in the Krishna book, it mentions that he did enter into a bit of a friendly relationship with Banasura. But in general, you know, that's the deal. An example of that, of course, a classic example of that is Hiranyakasipu. It's not like he was he offered prayers to Lord Brahma. He definitely did, and he performed tremendous austerity. But it's not like, you know, Lord Brahma and him had a thick and thin relationship. He just knew how to play the game, you know, Hiranyakasipu, and he got that benediction. So anyway, point being that, so these so-called devotees or followers of Rudra, they can be a menace. And Prabhupada goes on to say they are sometimes dangerous even to Rudra himself. And the classic example of that, of course, is Vrikashura. And as dear Alita was starting to say. So that's an interesting story. Vrikashura, he was addressed at one point by the boy form of Lord Narayan that he will later meet as the king of the demons. So he was, you know, a prominent demon, and he wanted a benediction. He wanted a benediction. So, you know, these demons are not stupid. They know how to get what they want. So he went to Kashinath, which is up in the Himalaya Mountains. Did I get that right? Is that where he went? I think so. Huh? Kailash, yeah, sorry. Kailash, I knew I was saying something wrong. Kailash, right, which is up there. It's above the tree line. You know, it's not as high as Mount Everest or anything like that, but it's up there. And he went up there, and he decided, you know, well, if I want a benediction from Lord Shiva, let me just go to the place, you know, where it's like if you want the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, you go to Mayapur, and you know, something like that. He was going to the place that's famous for, this is the place of Lord Shiva, Kasinath, or Kailash. Right, Mount Kailash. So he gets up there, and as I said, it's way up above the tree line and everything, and he knows the drill. You know, he knows, okay, well, I got to make a sacrificial fire, because when you offer things to the demigods, they eat through the sacrificial fire. So he makes a sacrificial fire, and I don't know if it's because there was nothing else around or just because the guy was a little bit deranged, but rather than, you know, offer some fruits and vegetables or this or that, which you couldn't get anyway up there because it's above the tree line, there's nothing growing up there, but he decides to offer his own flesh, okay? He's going to offer pieces of his own body into the sacrificial fire. And that's his program. So he gets the fire going, And he starts, and just, I mean, as I'm saying this, try to imagine this, okay? Just like sometimes we hear things and we just go, yeah. But think about orphaning your own flesh. I mean, I'm so skinny, I couldn't offer too many pieces of flesh before there wouldn't be anything left of me. But, okay, maybe he was a good, chunky guy like that. So he has a knife of some sort, and he's cutting off pieces of his own flesh, and he's putting it in the fire. Okay, what? Swaha, yeah. And he's doing this for how many days did he do it for? 6 days. He's doing that for 6 days. You know, he's cutting himself, pieces of himself off and putting it in the fire. And he's doing it for 6 days. And after 6 days, he's feeling discouraged. He's thinking, well, I'm doing this for 6 days. It's not exactly fun. It's kind of, it's painful. And I'm not getting a result. That's the big thing. I don't care. I'm okay with it. I can keep doing it, but no result. So he decides, okay, I gotta up my game here. I gotta, take it to a higher level. And he goes, okay, I'm gonna offer myself into the fire. I'm just gonna go full on, and I'm gonna offer myself into the fire. So he knows the rules. So he goes to take a bath because, before you offer an animal in a sacrificial fire, you're supposed to bathe it. So he goes to bathe himself. And then he comes back, and he's getting ready to, go into the sacrificial fire. I think there's a picture showing how he's about to cut off his head first. It doesn't mention that, but the picture shows that. But anyway, so he's getting ready to go into the fire. And then lo and behold, Lord Shiva comes out from the sacrificial fire. And he goes, whoa, Vukeshwara, what's going on here? And Vukeshwara explains to him that, I came here to get a benediction, and I was offering my flesh into the fire, but you didn't come, and so I'm trying to, please you. And so he says, no. Lord Shiva goes, okay, don't worry. You don't have to do that. That's okay. And Prabhupada points out in the Krishna book, when he's telling the story, that it's not like Lord Shiva was really pleased by him or being particularly merciful or compassionate to him. He was just doing what any gentleman would do, Prabhupada mentions, that, anybody who sees somebody committing suicide, it's natural that they're going to go and do something to try to stop him. So that was what Lord Shiva was coming from by doing that. He just didn't want to see this guy unnecessarily, to no benefit, commit suicide. Because when you commit suicide, not only would he have not got the benediction because he committed suicide, he didn't think of that perhaps, but suicide is a sinful activity. There's a sinful reaction for committing suicide. You come back as a ghost. So Lord Shiva was just being a good guy, and let me try to stop this guy. I don't know, he's crazy, but anyway, I'll try to help him. And he came and he stopped, and so Vukeshwara was, agreed, okay, yeah, I won't try to, I'll cease and desist, And then Lord Shiva, very kindly, he touched him on the head, and he became okay again. His whole body that he cut pieces off and everything became whole again. But, and then he asked, okay, so, what benediction do you want? As I said, he's easily pleased, Lord Shiva, Ashutosh. So he offered him a benediction. And this fellow, Vukeshwara, he asked for the benediction that whose ever head I touch, it becomes like smashed. It explodes into pieces and they die. That's the benediction he asked for. And Lord Shiva, when he heard that, he thought, oh, man. I should have known. This guy's wacky enough to come all the way up here and offer his flesh in the fire and just contempt to commit suicide. I should have known that he's going to ask for some weird benediction, which would be dangerous to the whole, not just to himself, but the whole human society. And anyway, but I promised. I already said I'd do it, so I got to do it. So he gave him that benediction. So be it, like that. He gave him the benediction, and then Vukeshwara, true to form, he's got the benediction. He realized, okay, I got the benediction. And he thinks, wouldn't it be nice to have Lord Shiva's wife, Gauri, as my partner? She, she has a reputation of being very beautiful. And okay, so let me just test this benediction out on Lord Shiva. And if it works, okay, then I get. So he starts approaching Lord Shiva to touch Lord Shiva on the head. And Lord Shiva's going like, what? So he just cut out, he split. And he went to different places and different demigods. They couldn't do anything to help him. And finally, he went to, I think it was Bhadarik Ashram. And I'm going to read you something here. He goes to Bhadarik Ashram and he approaches Lord Narayan directly. And it's really, Lord Narayan is able to help him out. So what he does is he disguises himself as like a brahmachari. He's dressed as a brahmachari, you know, like he appears in a very young form. And when, Vrikashura, son of Shakuni, when he was following him, so, you know, Lord Shiva got there first, and then hot on his tail, Vrikashura gets there, and he's confronted by this brahmachari form of Lord Narayan. I'm going to read you this because I couldn't do justice to trying to tell this as a story, but I'll just read you exactly how Prabhupada wrote it, the ingenious way in which he, gets control of the situation. So this is Lord Narayan says to Vrikashura, he says, "My dear son of Shakuni, you appear very tired, as if coming from a distant place. What is your purpose? Why have you come so far? I see that you are fatigued, so I request you to take a little rest. You should not unnecessarily tire your body. Everyone greatly values his body because with his body only can one fulfill all the desires of one's mind. We should not, therefore, unnecessarily give trouble to this body." What a great Sankirtan devotee. He goes on to say, "My dear Lord, if you think you can disclose the mission for which you have taken the trouble to come here, maybe I shall be able to help you so that your purpose will be easily served." He says, and then Vrikashura tells him, you know, "Hey, well, this is the story. I mean, I was there. I went to get this benediction from Lord Shiva, and this happened, and this, and this. And he gave me the benediction, and then when I'm trying to use it, and he's running away." And anyway, so Lord Narayan, he gets the whole picture. And then he goes on to say, "I myself cannot believe that Lord Shiva has in truth given you such a benediction. As far as I know, Lord Shiva is not in a sane mental condition. When he had a quarrel with his father-in-law, Daksha, he was cursed to become a pisacha, ghost. Thus, he has become the leader of the ghosts and hobgoblins. Therefore, I cannot put any faith in his words. But if you still have faith in the words of Lord Shiva, my dear king of the demons, then why don't you make an experiment by putting your hand on your own head. If the benediction proves false, then you can at once kill this liar, Lord Shiva, so that in the future he will not dare give out false benedictions." And the reason I had to read that is because every time I read it, it's so worded so perfectly that I feel like I would have fell for it too, you know? It's just like really perfect. Anyway, that's what Lord Narayan as the brahmachari said. And sure enough, Vrikashura, he fell for it. He got covered over and he did that and he killed himself like that. So that's the story of Vrikashura. And that's it. And Prabhupada's talking about it. Sometimes his so-called devotees or followers are dangerous even to himself. And his descendants of Rudra sometimes make plans to kill Rudra by the grace of Rudra. So what's meant by that that phrase, by the grace of Rudra, is the benediction. You know, he gave him the benediction, but that's his grace, a blessing, you know, that you could touch somebody's head and it'll shatter into pieces. So, yeah, that's what's meant by that. And it says, that is the nature of his devotees. That's the nature of his devotees. So just a little something more on the nature of his devotees, the devotees of Lord Rudra. Anyway, that's enough said about those guys, about the devotees or the followers of Rudra. So now, we've already kind of made the point that Lord Shiva is not really, he's not pleased with his own so-called devotees or followers. Who is he pleased with? Well, in the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam, in that same, in that chapter, chanting the song by Lord Shiva, there's an interesting pastime exchange that happens. So the sons of King Prachinibari, they called the Prachetas, right? Yeah, yeah. So they're asked by their father to help populate, you know, to enter into the Grihastha ashram and populate the universe. And in preparation for that, they're going off to perform austerities. And to their really good fortune, as they're going out to the place where they were going to, because they were going to go and meditate under the water for 10,000 years, actually, a long time. So they meet Lord Shiva on the way. And it wasn't planned. You know, they just got lucky. They met Lord Shiva on the way. And there was an exchange there. And as part of that exchange, Lord Shiva said to them, this is where we get information of who Lord Shiva is actually pleased by. It says, the Prachetas were fortunate to see Shiva. Oh, no, that's not the one I want to read. Oh, yeah, okay. So here, this is Lord Shiva speaking. It says, you are all sons of King Prachinibari, and I wish all good fortune to you. I also know what you are going to do, and therefore I am visible to you just to show my mercy upon you. And in the purport, Prabhupada says, he says, the conclusion is that a devotee of Lord Shiva is not dear to Lord Shiva. So in case you were wondering, is Bhrigupati really correct about that? No, here it is in black and white. A devotee of Lord Shiva is not dear to Lord Shiva, but a devotee of Lord Krishna is very dear to Lord Shiva. See? So that's who's dear to Lord Shiva, the devotees of Krishna, not his so-called devotees. Okay, so now, what can we learn? What are the important lessons that we can learn from this today's translations and purport? Well, one is, that came to me, was, and this is pretty, it's obvious, and it's a big thing, it comes up a lot. Somebody could be very powerful, but that doesn't mean they have their head screwed on right. Follow what I'm saying? No, there's so many personalities within, you know, the Vedic literature we hear about. They're very powerful. But so, once again, somebody could be very powerful. Ravana was very powerful. Hiranyakasipu was very powerful. Jarasandha was very powerful. So many, you know, Hiranyakasipu was very powerful. They were all very powerful. And there's so many more examples of that, right? They didn't have their head screwed on right. These guys are like really perverse. See? So that's an important thing to understand, that somebody could be, power doesn't equate to like virtue or anything like that. No way. So that's one point. Now another point is, how do you respond to that? So now knowing that, you know, what should be our response to that? Well, we're getting information here from Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma, when he saw what was going on, when he saw that the sons and grandsons of Lord Shiva were, you know, devastating the universe, did he just sit by and go, well, you know, what to do? I tried, but no. He swung in, he took action. See, so you can't just, it's like that. That's the nature of the thing. That's the nature of, it's not the spiritual world, you know, but here in the material world, that is the nature of the thing, that there's going to be people who are very, very powerful, but really off. And it's not our duty to just sit by and let it happen. Lord Brahma didn't do that. Lord Brahma didn't just sit by and let the whole, you know, the Rudras just devour the whole universe and just kill him, for that matter. Okay? He did something. He approached Lord Rudra, his son, directly and, you know, preached to him and got him to agree to do something that would correct the situation. So, once again, this is an analogy here that for us that, you know, we're each one of us, we're individuals, you know, we're in a situation where we're in a society of devotees, right? And, you know, on the one hand, we have to be really careful. Vaishnava etiquette is super important, to observe Vaishnava etiquette and have, as far as possible, very, very nice interactions with all devotees. That's, you know, that's definitely there. But at the same time, We have to be, you know, you got to be aware of what's going on. If you see something, if you're aware of something that's going on that's not correct, you know, in the behavior of a, you know, somebody, another member of the community, or in general, you know, it's not. We don't have to be like blind. You know, you don't. We can also. There is some recourse. There is some. We're allowed to kind of express that our concern. I'm making the point clear? We're not like just pawns that, you know, you get moved around on a chessboard. No, we want to be observe Vaishnava etiquette. We want to be completely perfect ladies and gentlemen. But at the same time, we're thoughtful. You know, devotee can be thoughtful and have, you know, see things and express concern. And I'll give you an example of this. I hope I made the point well. Here's what I consider a good example. There was a situation in India, in Mayapur. One of the Bhaktivinoda Thakur had 13 children. Okay? So two of them became very prominent devotees. The most famous would be of course, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, Prabhupada's spiritual master. But he had a brother. I can't remember if it was a younger brother or older brother, but he had a brother who was also a devotee, a very, you know, serious devotee, Lalit Prasad. So somehow or another, Lalit Prasad was the one who was in charge of the legacy, you know, the property and et cetera, and a lot of literature of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Somehow or another, he was in charge of that. He was taking care of that. But it wasn't doing great. He was, unlike his brother, he wasn't a spiritual master with a lot of disciples and a following. And, you know, he just was more or less not a Babaji, but a Bhajanandi, more along those lines, from what I can understand. So he didn't have a lot of resources, the point I'm getting to. He didn't have resources. And so the property of Bhaktivinoda Thakur was becoming run down. It was, you know, it fallen into ill repair. It was getting dilapidated. And the devotees were aware of this. Prabhupada was aware of this. And they weren't happy about it because they thought, this is important. You know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is his bhajan kutir, his samadhi, whatever the things related to him. These are important things for Vaishnavs, you know, the important places of pilgrimage and spiritual inspiration. So they wanted to do something, not to take it all. He wanted to help. So Prabhupada, on one occasion, went to see him with Jayapataka Maharaj. And they, you know, they were talking and everything. They exchanged cordiality, you know, all the proper things. And at some point, Prabhupada introduced the subject. And, you know, I don't know exactly what I said, but this is what I was, because I was told the story. I wasn't there, obviously. But basically, he presented his concern to Lalit Prasad in the form of a question. He said, do you think it's right? Do you think it's good that the, you know, the legacy of Bhaktivinoda Thakur is being neglected? And he presented like that. And then afterwards, and then, of course, you know, he elaborated. I don't know what else he said, but that was the gist of it, you know. Then afterwards, Jayapataka Maharaj asked Srila Prabhupada, how come you did like that? How come you presented it like that? You know, kind of, not very forcefully, but kind of more. He said, well, and Prabhupada explained to him, said, Prabhupada explained it. Lalit Prasad is my senior. You know, he's the God brother. He's the brother. What to speak of God? He's the brother of my spiritual master, and he's a very senior, elevated devotee. So, according to Vaishnava etiquette, he's my senior. So I have. But also, according to Vaishnava etiquette, you're allowed to ask a question to a superior. You could present a question to a superior. So that's why I presented it like that. And Jayapataka Maharaj said, "Okay, thank you." So, is an example, you know, how we can ourselves, you know, follow in the footsteps. That's the last point I'm going to make. But we can be proper devotees, you know, observing all the etiquette and everything like that. But at the same time, we can, you know, have opinions. We can be thoughtful. We don't have to just kind of be like, you know, horses with the blinders. If you see something that you don't think is right or that's bothering you, you can express that, but there's a proper way to do it. And I think that's it's a challenge, but I think in order to continue in Krishna consciousness with, if you're, you know, by nature, if you're a thoughtful, intelligent person with good mental health, you got to learn how to do that. You got to learn how to be simultaneously very humble, submissive, follow the etiquette, but at the same time, present things that are kind of, you know, don't seem quite right to you, to the, in the appropriate way, to the appropriate people, and get your conflicts, you know, resolved. Maybe even something, you know, will change and something will come of it. So I'll stop there. Sachidanoi Prabhu. Before Archita leaves, you want to say something? You're okay. While he's getting the mic, I want to say two more. I'll say one more thing, okay? And then, if you, I just want to make the point that, you know, somebody, this statement I just made, because, you know, I'm directing that to people who are like really participating in ISKCON properly. Like Prabhupada wanted his followers to be chanting 16 rounds, following the four greater principles. If they're living close and they're able to attend the program, do service. These are people who I feel have a right to get involved. You know, if you're somebody who's like outside, you're not following the principles, you're not chanting, you're not doing any service, mind your own business. Sorry. You know. But anyway, go ahead.
So thank you, Prabhu. This is a comment and probably a question too. The example that you just gave me an insight to another thing that happened, almost similar, maybe a little bit different. That is, and you probably are more familiar with this, something that happened when a very advanced or senior devotee at one time married to, it's a couple, I think it was the temple president in New York, mm-hmm. and he was doing some offerings that very inappropriate, and the community knew about it. And those who were peers, or this, you can say leaders, senior devotees, didn't do anything to correct it. And the younger ones, they were all bewildered, because we know as seniors, peer, how am I going to say that? Yeah. So they remained like, they knew about it, but they didn't do anything, and the seniors were supposed to do something. So
I was there.
Yeah. So then these kinds of things,
anyway,
like, you know, blind following, like you say, blind followers, but there are people who knows who are not, might necessarily be blind followers, who just don't want to have that, how to say, the guts to go and confront. But not just anyone can do that, of course, because you're transgressing etiquette, like you just mentioned. But it can bring a lot of dangers to when something is not doing immediately, a chaos, something, this, how to say, a disaster can happen. Mm. And there are many other issues like that now happening too, that sometimes younger devotees, they just get frustrated because they cannot do anything. You know, you have to go through all the etiquettes, and after they go, maybe you go to your superior, they don't do anything, they go to the GVCs, and they still that. They maybe might not necessarily resolve the issue, and you just have to, I guess, what is your opinion? Just be patient. You did what you could, but the problem is still there.
Well, I don't consider myself an authority on the matter, since you asked me what's my opinion. In the eighth canto, there's a purport where, you know, Prabhupada talks about how Gajendra was in the water there and he was out of his element. And Prabhupada says, you know, okay, all the members of the Krishna conscious movement should have managed their life, organized their life in such a way that they have sensual power, you know, et cetera, like that. So at the end of the purport, it says, don't give up the fight and go away. That's the final thing. So that's what I would say. Just however frustrated you may feel about something or other, don't do that. Keep talking. You know, find somebody who can that you feel some satisfaction talking to. Maybe, you know, that person will be sympathetic or help you see things in another light or help you realize you're right, but just whatever you do, don't give up the fight and go away. That's the most helpful advice I could give to anybody who's disturbed about anything that they see happening with the ISKCON. Just stay on the boat. You know, Prabhupada said, there's a letter, somebody wrote Prabhupada a letter about, I'm not getting along with this one, I'm not getting along with that one. And Prabhupada wrote back saying, our connection is not with this man or that man. He said, just like if you're getting on a train, you can't expect everybody in the train to be first class, or on a boat. He said, but our connection is with the philosophy and the process of life. He said, it doesn't matter whether you get along with this one or that one. Not everybody's first class. He acknowledged it. Not everybody in the there's discrepancies. But our connection is with the philosophy and the process of life. In other words, we're connected with Krishna. You're connected with Krishna if you're following the process and you're following the philosophy like that. And, there might be discrepancies. There's obviously discrepancies. We haven't done everything perfectly. Anybody can understand that. But still, conviction has to be that, the philosophy is perfect and the process is perfect. And if I just can sincerely stick to that, then I'm okay. I'm in safe ground.
Prabhu, correct me maybe in this. When that incident happened in New York, you were there. You said you were there. Wasn't it that Srila Prabhupada was pleased to see that at the same time that the younger devotees remained there, continued with their service, but at the same time he got upset from the other ones, leaders, who didn't, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I remember. I can't remember where I heard that from, but he was upset with, no need to mention names, but he was upset. He was chastised. The senior leaders like that, but he said that the other devotees they did the right thing. They were just following. They didn't. But you guys should have known better, and you should have done something. So that was the fact. Gauranga praying. It's half day fast, so I'm not in any rush.
Regarding to Sachdanoy Prabhu's question, mm-hmm. It reminds me of a class given by my Guru Maharaj, Tamalakrishna Maharaj. So in the class, my Guru Maharaj, he was saying that if you are not a pure devotee, then you do not have the right to pick the fault of the others. So first, you yourself. But if you are a pure devotee, then you can pick up the fault of the others. But if you are not, then you do not have the right to pick up the fault of the others. So first, you have to pick up the fault of yourself. My Guru Maharaj was saying like that,
That's a good point, and I know your Guru Maharaj. I'm not sure. I'm not going to say it's incorrect, but I don't know how practical it is. I'll give you an example, okay? I'll use myself. I'm not famous for being the best driver, okay? Sometimes, devotees drive with me, and my wife used to say, you must have some angel protecting you because, So I'm taking out devotees who are younger devotees than me. Does that mean they can't say something to me about my driving? No, they should. If they say, Bhrigu Padi, please don't look at the phone and do that at the same time, or don't do this. No, they have a right to do that. Their lives are at risk. So even though they might not be a pure devotee, they can... I feel that they're justified in saying something to me about my driving if they feel uncomfortable, if they're feeling unsafe by something they see me doing or not doing. You follow what I'm saying? So as much as possible, we want to become pure devotees. We should, before we're correcting somebody else. But sometimes, practically, we have to... But not in the mood of fault-finding, just practically we have to point out something to keep the show on the road. Anyway, I think it's a good example. So I just wanted to modify it. It's correct, but I just wanted to modify the understanding. Yeah, Prema, and then Babu. Is that okay?
So you said before then, even if somebody didn't chant all 16 rounds, or maybe don't follow principle, but still a devotee, okay? You said he should not point, if I understand properly, if he sees something wrong. But according to what you just said, why not? So if they see something's wrong, what's the problem to not point out?
Okay, yeah, actually, good point. And they can point out, but they have to do it with a proper attitude.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in other words, like, say somebody's a member of our congregation, they're not somebody who's chanting regularly 16 rounds or following the four greater principles. They shouldn't be a vicious critic. You know, there's a difference between being a vicious critic and a well-wishing, person who wants to offer some advice that may be helpful. You see, so if, you know, you have to do it with the right mentality that, hey, you know, in the mood of like, hey, I know I'm not really one of you guys and I'm not doing the work what you're doing, but I think if you did like this, it might be helpful. Yeah, that's nice. That's welcome. That's appreciated. But not like if you're not part of it, you know, if you're not part of the organization, you're not rolling up. Like if I were to go start, you know, say to Rabindranath, you know, Rabindranath in the Didi department, it should be done like this. It should be done like that. What? I don't do any service there. I'm not involved there. It's none of my business. I mean, you know, he's got all the responsibility, all the pujaris. They're doing all the hard work. What's my position to come and say, do this, don't do that? No. I could offer some nice, humble suggestion. Prabhu, I don't know. You know, do you think it might be nice if this, something like that? But so that, you're right. Those people can have input, but they have to do it in the right mood.
Certain issues in which they're more experts. Some people outside in trying to deal with many things that we might not necessarily, in the practical sense, be expert. But they hear a feedback. They come and they advise you.
That's a good point. Shravan and then Mother Shyamapriya.
I was wondering what have. First of all, thank you very much for a beautiful lecture. Really nicely presented, you know, how I was really shocked to hear that Lord Shiva wasn't pleased with his devotees, but he's pleased with the
devotees of Krishna.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know that, you know, reading from, you know, what Prabhupada wrote. That's wonderful. My question is, what happens to all the Rudras?
What happens to?
The millions of Rudras, and they're no longer there now, right? So does Lord Shiva destroy them? Or?
No mention that they're destroyed, but okay. I guess they just have to chill out. You know, I can't remember anything, reading anything that says about. But I know they did stop. Mother Shyamapriya, and then Acharya.
Hare Krishna, thank you for discussing this subject. It's interesting that some of the most successful organizations, they have a process of brainstorming and taking a lot of feedback to find out and what could be better, what's going wrong, how to improve, how to work as a team to achieve the goal. And because, you know, one brain or two brains, they cannot see all the different perspectives and different angles on things. When you have a multi-vision on one thing, you can get a very clear understanding of what the thing is and how to make the steps forward. And I just wanted to bring that up because it's becoming very... a lot of success is being found in this way of moving forward with... groups of people who want to achieve something.
Is that word synergy? You know, when you get everybody involved, you get synergy. And the definition of the synergy, my simple definition, the whole is greater than the sum total of the parts. In other words, you get people involved, say you have like a community, for instance, with 20 intelligent people, and so that each one of them is like a unit, and you get each one of them involved in, the direction of that project, but the sum total of the energy that's created to move that project forward is more than 20 units, because somehow or another, the whole is greater than the sum total of the parts. People, they enthuse each other and they get inspiration from each other, and it just kind of creates something, a different, phenomena, and it's actually more powerful. So yeah, I could see how that would be a good thing. It's more time consuming. I'm guilty of not doing that. When I was a temple president in Auckland, New Zealand at one point, and we had a council, and on the council there's about 12 members, and about I think 5 were men and 7 were women on the council, and when we had the meetings, things would really drag, something would come up for discussion, it would really drag, and I just noticed that I think there was like a social element there, that because it was men and women, we were all much younger at the time, and it was this person and his wife, and I just kind of felt like, this is not working. It's not. There's a lot of certain amount of subtle sex life that's kind of slowing things down. So I made a proposal that, and I thought to myself, well, Prabhupada didn't manage with women. Prabhupada managed with men. So why do I have to try to manage with women? So I made a proposal that the women should be, shouldn't be part of the council. I presented, and I made the proposal at the meeting, and they discussed it, and then we took a vote, and the women got voted off the council. Okay? And so I was successful. I got the women off the council. One of the women was... One of the women was a disciple of Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and she was the wife of the headmaster of the school, and she was a disciple of Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and they told him about it, and they also told him how upset they were about this. She was the what do you call it, like the secretary. She was really bright. She was like, she could type as you spoke. She's speaking, and she's taking minutes for the meeting, and they were like qualified women on the council there, and so they were upset, and they approached Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj told him, he knew me. I was on Radhadamodar, so he knew me from there. And he says, he doesn't know how to manage. Okay. Don't worry about it. Anyway, so I got the women off the council, and they got me out of the temple presidency. I got removed. But so anyway, it was an interesting situation. But it definitely requires more maturity, because it's time-consuming. You have to listen to what other people have to say. You have to be prepared to think about it, respond to it. It's much quicker and easier, and that's why I wanted to do it. That's why I didn't want to have women on the council, because I wanted to just go snap, 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 and just get things done. But sometimes that's, and that's good in a certain time, in a certain situation, that's good. But, if, like a boat, it's kind of, you can't just go like that. It has to move very slowly and deliberately. Sometimes for a bigger organization, you have to be prepared to take that time and energy to hear from people and like that. So yeah, I can appreciate the value of that kind of approach. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I would, on that point about the women, that's one of the problems we have, is that women don't have any representation or any voice, and therefore they feel disconnected. And if you feel disconnected, and then one loses interest, basically. If the women lose interest, then who are the men going to marry, and how are we going to create future generations of devotees? And even how many men will stay in the temple if it's just guys here? The women have so much to offer, and they do so many things, and they have a different perspective. And I know men find it annoying to try to get around the mind of the women a lot of the time, but they have a perspective that is very real, because they're the mothers. They understand the importance of so many things. A woman doesn't see this. A woman sees the whole story. I'm talking about intelligent women. They see the whole panorama of what's going on. They're not just seeing, oh yeah, let's just fix this thing. You fix this thing, like science is a wonderful example. They create so many things, and they don't see they're creating behind them a catastrophe of unthought over results of what they're doing. Because they're just seeing, oh yes, we'll do this and it'll be better and we'll make money and we'll change the world. But they're not seeing about the little guy, all the people who lose their jobs, all the people who are lose their home, or what, all the things that happen as a result.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman has this vision because her job in life is to raise children, run a home, and multitask in so many ways. So they have this incredible broad vision. And if we don't have the two things working side by side, like you have Shiva and Uma,
yeah,
you have Lakshmi Narayan, all the gods, they all have their female counterpart, because that completes a whole which is greater than either one individually.
Right, synergy.
Yeah, synergy. It's the same thing. So if we dismiss the view of the women just because they're troublesome, and I can understand can be like that sometimes, but if we just dismiss that, then we get, you know, you're going to end up with a different thing than what Prabhupada was talking about, because Prabhupada included women very much so and gave them positions, and he allowed them to do all kinds of things according to their propensity, because after all we are a society of the soul, not of the body. So he saw that, you know, despite which body this soul has, he has these qualities and these things he can offer to Krishna. Let me engage them all, because after all, this is a time of dire necessity.
Time of?
Dire necessity.
Yep.
It's a time where our choices make how the future will be. And if we make the wrong choices in this movement and we discount 50% of our members as irrelevant, we're not going to be able to change the world.
Mm.
I'm sorry. But we need to, you know, get off the bodily platform and work on the soul platform and start helping the world situation in a more dynamic way.
Thank you. That's a great comment. Acharya, you want to? Just out of curiosity, does anybody know, and because now Mother Vishaka is the temple president at the manor, do they have women? Yeah. Yeah. She's been for about a year now, right? Do women lead kirtans there or give classes?
When I was there, I led kirtan there.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not the Guru Puja so much, but it wasn't that it didn't happen. I don't know how it is now. I haven't been there.
But would a woman be allowed to, say, lead Mangal Arati or Guru Puja, if, you know, if she wanted to? And
I don't know. You have to. Maybe I get a chance to go there.
I'm just curious about their policy.
But I was in Soho Street, and definitely I've led Mangal Arati, I've led Guru Puja, Tulsi Puja, Nisringadev prayers, given class. Yeah.
Oh, you gave class?
Hmm?
You're allowed to give class?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And in the manor, I gave class as well.
Okay.
Back years ago. I mean, that's like 25 years ago. I'm not sure, actually.
I'm just curious. You want to say something? Go ahead, Prem. Oh, yeah? Wait, get the microphone.
You know, I just get back from Aracha Temple, and the temple president, is Mother Mukya, who is one of Prabhupada's disciples. And I'm feeling she's actually quite qualified.
She's qualified, you feel?
Yeah, okay. And there are so many Matajis. You know, they are leading Mangalati prayers, Guru Puja prayers. They are even giving Srimad Bhagavatam classes, you know. I'm a little bit surprised to see that, of course, you know, compared to our, you know, temple here in LA, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the feeling there are some, you know, Matajis, you know, they are really very qualified. Although Srila Prabhupada, he often said, you know, in the Shastra that women generally are considered less intelligent. Therefore, they have to be protected all her life. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, you know, they have to be protected by the father when they were young, or protected by the husband, or grown-up sons like that, you know. But when I was in a larger temple, somehow I got a feeling we do have some nice, you know, qualified you know, devotee marriage is in our movement, you know, I'm feeling like that, you know.
Yeah. Nice, yeah. Anybody else, anything they want to say? Okay, thank you very much. Going to write Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Felt comfortable in doing in front of Lord Shiva.